Thank you for attending this, which is the second in our series of centenary lectures. And before we get to introducing the speaker and the lecture itself, I have to introduce two items of housekeeping. One is that the safety exits are behind you and at the back, halfway down that wall, if there's a fire. And the second one is to beg anybody, including myself, if they've got a mobile phone, to switch it off. Now, it's my great pleasure to introduce you to David Brown, this evening's speaker. After obtaining a first-class degree from Liverpool University in engineering, he went on and spent 4 years gaining a postgraduate degree in warship design. He then joined the Royal Corps of Naval Constructors, with whom he worked for all his working life until he retired in 1988. And while he worked for the Royal Corps of Naval Constructors, he designed small ships, frigates, nuclear submarines, hovercraft, and hydrofoils. He helped set up a postgraduate course in warship design at UCL, and in 1972 he organised the Froude Centenary celebrations at Haslar, and so very appropriate to be our speaker. Since retiring in 1988, he's been a consultant, he's looked at, for example, the loss of the Herald for Free Enterprise. He's also worked for the research committee of the Lighthouse Authorities. He was a vice president of the Royal Institution of Naval Architects for many years. He's written 11 books, one of which is on William Froude, the subject of this evening's lecture. Now, William Froude has a very special place in the history of engineering science at Oxford. Not only did he invent the dynamometer, which reached engineering practice through Heenan and Froude, now called Froude-Hoffmann, but he also applied dimensional analysis to the scale modelling of ships, and his ideas are taught worldwide to, I think, almost every student of civil, mechanical, chemical engineering. So he's more famous, in my opinion, worldwide than Brunel. So David Brown is going to talk to us on William Froude, The Sacred Duty of Doubt. The lecture has been very kindly sponsored by Froude-Hoffmann Limited, the company that was founded on the basis of William Froude's invention. So a very nice circle. Thank you, David Brown.
Well, good evening. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Slide, please. Yep, next one. The Proverbs tell us there are a number of things which we can never understand, one of which is the way of a ship in the midst of the sea, another is the way of a man with a maid, but I'm not talking on that tonight. I want to talk very much about the way in which Froude worked, the way his mind worked. And this is unusually well documented. There are his learned society papers, of course, which are obvious starting point. There is a lengthy correspondence, 35 years of it, between Froude and his former tutor, John Henry Newman, later the Cardinal. Specifically, quite a lot of this correspondence is on the nature of proof in science and religion. And as Newman went to faith, Froude got more and more agnostic. His last letter was virtually a case for atheism. And they were still friends. In this correspondence, Froude very often uses the phrase, our sacred duty to doubt. And sometimes he expanded this by our sacred duty to doubt each and every proposition put to us, including our own. I invite you in the next hour to see how well he lived up to his duty to doubt. And I also invite you to notice how many times he's described as idle by his friends. Frankly, as an undergraduate, and later as a postgraduate, I was bored stiff by the workings of Froude. My teachers seemed to think it was a mechanical process by which you did a model test, turn the handle, and the answer came out. Once I got involved, I discovered it was nothing like so straightforward. The process worked, but it required judgment and experience to make it work. William Froude was born in 1810, please. Oh, that's William. Next one. He was born and brought up in Dartington Parsonage. This is a relatively recent picture, and it's changed quite a bit since Froude's time. but it was still a very pleasant place. Froude's father was Archdeacon of Totnes, and it's very hard to understand what sort of a person he was. Most of the accounts we have are by the younger son, Anthony Froude, who was known as a historian, and who really hated his father. And it was some very nasty things. Both John Henry Newman and William Froude are rather kind to the old boy and suggest that he had quite a lot of fun in him. Froude's mother was Margaret Spedding, of a fairly prosperous Lake District family, which prided themselves on both beauty and intelligence. Froude's mother died of tuberculosis when William was only 8 years old, but it's probable that his mother had already influenced him to some extent. We can tell that the sort of thing she tried to produce to her sons, but in a letter to an older son, in which she said, "The virtuous man is the happy man," and she goes on to define virtue as stretching both mind and body to the utmost, willingly and not through fear of punishment. William went to Westminster School, where he did very well. He got a scholarship first to the school and then a scholarship to Oxford, which was directed to Christchurch College. However, William didn't want to go to Christchurch, he wanted to go to Oriel, where I gather I'm going to stay tonight, in his memory, where his older brother, Hurrell, was already a tutor. Hurrell actually wrote at this time saying he thought William would do quite well if he wasn't too idle. William's other tutor was in fact John Henry Newman, and they were of course both leaders in the Oxford movement in the reformation of the Anglican Church. William joined in the debate with a vigour for which he was later to apologise. But he had another number of fringe interests. A contemporary said you could always recognise William's room in Oriel College from the sulfuric acid stains down the wall outside his window. It's probable that he ran a model railway at that time and worked on modifying a yacht for seagoing work, and it's probable that his skill with tools developed while he was still an undergraduate. On graduating in 1833, William went to work for a very well-known railway engineer called Palmer on the Southeastern line. Palmer in 1824 had done model experiments on canal barges, and it's possible that Froude picked up some ideas on model testing from him. He didn't do anything very prominent with Palmer. I think he was what we would now call a graduate trainee. In 1837, William became an assistant to I.K. Brunel on the Bristol to Exeter Railway, working under a man called Gravett. And it probably helped that his father, the Archdeacon, was a shareholder in Brunel's railway. In 1841, Brunel was dissatisfied with Gravett's work and told him to discharge himself and all the assistants except Froude, and that Froude was to take over all the work of the line. And very bravely, in my mind, that very night that he was appointed, Froude wrote to Brunel suggesting that Brunel had got the route for the summit section wrong, and there was a much better route. Not bad for a new assistant to a man like Brunel. Froude was now age 31. In the prime of life, and ideas began to flow. He developed a new system of brickwork. Slide, please. For skew bridges, so that the... Oh, sorry. You can admire that while I continue talking. He developed a new system of brickwork for skew bridges, so that the mortar was in compression rather than in shear. He developed a way of canting, tilting a curved railway line on the approach to a bend to reduce the shock on the passengers. And he also did a paper on the expansion of steam, a fairly theoretical paper. And he sent a draft of this to Brunel, who replied in language so rude that it can only have been from a close friend. In 1844, William carried out the survey for the West Somerset and Weymouth line, after which he took a six-month sick leave, which is a complete mystery. There's no indication what form this sickness took. Disinclinitis, perhaps. He came back to work on a survey of the North Devon line, which failed to win parliamentary approval. William actually offered to forego his year's salary, which Brunel thought would be bad publicity, and was not accepted. Then in 1846, aged 36, William retired. You know, earlier accounts say that he retired to nurse his ailing father. Well, ailing father lived to a ripe old age, and there were plenty of servants to do the nursing. I think, in fact, William devoted himself to managing the family estate, which was quite extensive, thanks to a happy marriage two or three generations back. The next slide, please. Doodlings from his book, from his railway days. Nobody's been able to identify which tunnel that is. So we got him into retirement. He was far from idle, but he was unworthy of a brilliant engineer in the prime of his life. He was a JP, he was a harbour commissioner for Dartmouth. He designed the sea defences which still are in use at Dartmouth. He was a turnpike trustee, but these were all the sort of things that any country gentleman would do. He was also a judge of agricultural machinery at the Bath and West Show, and this is rather more significant. There are papers which don't appear in the collected technical papers, but he condemned one machine's unprincipled in not matching thickness to stress, and went on to deride the same particular machine as professional immorality. He really did feel upset by sloppy thinking. In 1850, William carried out tests in Lake Bathenthwaite with a 3-foot-long clockwork model. There's no full account of this work, but it seems to have given him quite a few ideas about the interaction between the propeller and the hull of a ship. In the introduction, it wasn't mentioned that probably one of the most important things in my life was designing propellers rather than ships. And it is well said that you become a propeller designer when you stop thinking of a propeller as something that drives a ship and think of a ship as something that obstructs the flow of water into the propeller. next slide, please. The Torquay water supply was always fairly dodgy, and it was diminishing due to corrosion and other muck forming on the inside of the main supply pipe. So a man called Appold devised a scraper which was actually propelled along the pipe by the water pressure in the pipe. And Appold died before he finished this work. It was taken over by Froude, who developed and improved the thing on the same principle. And there's a lovely description in Henry Brunel's notebook of five distinguished gentlemen in top hats walking along this country road with their ear to the ground, listening to the sound of the scraper. But this work on the Torquay water main led to Froude's thinking about the friction of water over solid surfaces. And he discovered that the frictional force increased at less than the square of the speed, which was contrary to his belief at the time. He also was a favoured person of the Torquay waterworks, and when he built his big test tank, he was actually allowed the water free. There were a few other short jobs for Brunel, mainly surveys, where William's ability to get on with people was invaluable. It's perhaps revealing that when offered one such job, Brunel described it as a gentlemanly task, that is to say, an idle sort of surveillance. He also developed a new seal for the atmospheric railway, which Brunel had built in the South Devon line. But though it was tested on full scale, the line was already on its last legs and it was never developed. At least it was developed. It was used by the Germans to launch flying bombs. In 1857, Froude's wife was converted to Catholicism by John Henry Newman and ceased attending family prayers, which was very disturbing in the culture of the day. And it's been suggested, without any real evidence, that this is why Froude began to take an interest in outside work, to keep away from the domestic strife. In 1856, Brunel was deeply involved with the big ship Great Eastern and hired Froude to work on both the launching arrangements and on the rolling of this big ship. William's work on the friction of steel launchways doesn't seem to have had any effect on the problems, but he did show that conventional views on friction were wrong. The original plan for the rolling study was for William Bell to carry out model tests and Froude to work on a theoretical study. In fact, the two Williams soon found that they got on much better if they shared the work equally between them. The Great Eastern was the first occasion on which the vertical centre of gravity and the weight of the ship had been calculated a priori. And in the round about 1860-something, late 1860s, a senior Admiralty naval architect said that this calculation was impossible, as it was so lengthy and tedious it could never be done. So Froude jumps to his feet and said, "Bell and I did it for the Great Eastern, and if you can do it for the world's biggest ship, you can do it for any other." Year 1859 was a rather sad year. Froude's father, the Archdeacon, died, and so did Brunel. The oldest son of William and Catherine, who took the family name of Hurrell, converted to Catholicism, meaning he could no longer live in college. He had to move into digs in the town. This is the Hurrell who designed the Blackpool Tower for Heenan and Froude, whom we welcome again tonight. On the death of his father, Froude moved into a rented house at Paignton first, but between 1863 and 1867, William and his friends designed and built a large house, slide please, at Chelston Cross on the outskirts of Torquay. The house still stands. Until recently it was a hotel. It's now been converted into flats, so I'm not quite sure what the present state is. It is a listed Grade 2 building, so one hopes that some of it is there. Just about everybody had a finger in the pie. Mary Brunel designed the gardens. Henry and William did all sorts of bits and pieces. Let's have the next slide, please. This was a small tank originally used for rolling experiments, later the hotel swimming pool, as you see it. And next slide, please. And disguised as the house chapel. What's interesting is that, next piece, as I said, just about everybody had a hand in the design, but there's no mention of any ideas from Mrs. Froude. I think she must have laid down her requirements at the beginning and said, "Now do what you like with the rest." This flying staircase is attributed to Henry Brunel, but there's very little in Henry Brunel's papers to suggest any serious work. I think almost certainly Henry did a back-of-the-envelope sketch and others developed the design, but it was always known both locally in the Torquay area and at Hassle as Henry Brunel's staircase. Of course, the health and safety executive had some problems when the building was a hotel. Next, please. And there is, we think that's Henry. Bristol University's Brunel Library are a little bit uncertain as to whether it really is Henry Brunel or not. But we can't find anything better, so we'll call it Henry. So, going back to Froude's work on rolling for Brunel, there had been nothing serious published on the rolling of ships in the previous 100 years. Rolling was just a fact of life at sea, and you had to put up with it. William's first experiments were on a little float, next please, a 2-inch diameter ring carrying a tiny pendulum. Using this device, he discovered fairly rapidly that the apparent vertical in waves was normal to the wave surface and not a true vertical. This next slide, please, bears on subjective impressions of wave height and also on subjective wave motion characteristics. It's not uncommon for a pendulum on the bridge of a ship to give indicated roll angles double the true angles. Froude used this tiny little float to demonstrate that reducing the stability actually reduced rolling. These two vital discoveries were due to observation and worked up into a mathematical theory with a lot of help from William Bell. An interesting point here is that at this time, when he was developing this mathematical theory of rolling, Froude was 50 years old and Bell was 42. It's usually held that original mathematics is virtually unknown as after the age of 30. Yet here were these two old boys going strong in 40s and 50s. Froude read a paper on this rolling work to the newly formed Institution of Naval Architects in 1861, and within its declared limits, the work remains valid today. It wasn't much use when it was published, as really, to use it, you need a large computer and also some knowledge of probability theory. The main conclusion of Froude's work were all ships with the same natural period of roll will move in the same way in an identical seaway. The worst roll is when the ship's natural period is equal to the period at which the waves are encountered. And ships with the longest period, that is the least stability, will roll the least. The Admiralty, in the shape of Chief Constructor Edward Reed, was supportive, while one of Reed's assistants, a man called Crossland, developed an alternative approach which came to the same answers. Froude was well aware of the difficulties in using his work, and over the next decade read several more papers, mainly directed to empirical solutions. These brought a nice tribute from Scott Russell on one such meeting. Each time we come together, something which was almost impossible last time has been done. We live, in short, in a time when the impossibilities of yesterday become the achievements of today. Froude and Scott Russell were not friends, but they were polite, at least in public. Henry Brunel's writings are fairly highly coloured, and I think he overdid the disagreement between Froude and Scott Russell. In 1863, Scott Russell read a short paper to the Naval Architects. Froude's contribution to the discussion was actually longer than the original paper. It's particularly notable for footnote in which he showed the conditions for his law of comparison. Speed is proportional to the square root of the length. In the same footnote, he notes that friction obeys different law from wave-making resistance. And this was before his better-known work. In 1870, Froude was appointed to the Admiralty Committee on Designs and also to the Royal Society, indication of professional respectability. In 1871, he carried out some tests on two large models of the battleship Devastation, and you'll see a slide of Devastation in a minute or two. He developed an elegant and complicated method of analysing rolling and noted that the resistance to rolling varied as velocity rather than velocity squared, suggesting that something other than friction was taking part. On travelling again and again over the whole question, the idea suddenly suggested itself that the waves created by the oscillation have been left out of account. He remembers the boy standing up in a small boat and rocking it to make waves. This short passage brings out two of my main points. First, Froude frequently used aphorism, "It is our sacred duty to doubt each and every proposition put to us, including our own." Here, Froude doubts extend to whether friction could account for the damping of rolling. He He also used the word suddenly, suggested itself. Now, in debate with Newman, he refused to accept the sudden flash of genius, which Newman referred to as the illative sense. Perhaps we get an explanation in a letter of 1853. Froude wrote, "Science progresses only by the following clues. It is only when, in such pursuit, our stock of acknowledged principles failed to account for some unmistakably residuary phenomenon, that experimentalists venture cautiously to think they have really got hold of what may turn out to be a new and unacknowledged principle." Froude's other favourite saying was, "Probability is the guide to life." So it was probably only this very last step that was sudden. Newman was rather fond of differentiating between scientific certainties and matters of faith. He would usually quote Newton's law of gravity as a certainty, but Froude wouldn't have this. He said that Newton's law was only the best fit to available data, and that one day we might have to change the law of gravity to meet new data. I wish I'd been able to copy that to Einstein. In August 1872, Froude supervised a trial on the effectiveness of bilge keels. The 1,200-ton sloop Greyhound, and again we'll see a slide of her in a minute in another context, was given bilge keels 3.5 feet deep and 100 feet along the length of the ship, while her sister Perseus had no bilge keels. They were placed onto broadside onto waves with a period of 4 to 5 seconds. Greyhound rolled with an average roll of 6 degrees, whereas Perseus was nearly twice as bad. And a later trial showed that the drag of the bilge keels was not particularly serious. From his earlier work, Froude knew that an ordinary pendulum would give misleading results, and he designed a very long period pendulum. Slide, please. Oh, we've missed one. Carry on. Yep, that's it. This is a very long period pendulum, and it's still on display at South Kensington in the Science Museum. At least it was last year. Next, please. This was first used for a major series of trials in the new battleship Devastation. Next, please. 400 men were run backwards and forwards across the deck to make the ship roll. Now, I should be very grateful indeed if somebody can show me how you get 400 men on the deck of a ship like that. She's 300 feet long, by the way. The account is quite definite on the 400 men, and there was a later trial in which the King of Portugal wanted a demonstration. And they did a mini trial with only 200 men. Even 200 is a bit difficult to fit on. There's an interesting note in Henry Brunel's diary on this trial. He notes that the ship's officers were kind, agreeable, cordial, and wondering, and very helpful. Not in the least reactionary, as so many accounts of Victorian naval officers describe them. Once again, it demonstrates Froude's ability to get on with people. People of all types. And this batch shown after the Devastation trials, they rejoined the fleet, and the band of another battleship, the Sultan, struck up a musical ditty of the day, "Willie, we've missed you." Froude returned to discussion of scientific method in another letter to Newman. The most important point he makes: "Great scientific discoveries are but the crowning results of some series of long-continued and patient inquiry, of men whose minds are for the most part well-disciplined, perceive the bearing and upshot of their experimental facts, as to decipher the experiments and see the facts they present." This is always seemed very similar to Louis Pasteur's fairly well-known saying, "In the field of observation, chance favours only the trained observer." One can just about justify his use of the word suddenly. Picking up his other phrase, "Probability is the guide to life," means that he couldn't accept Newman's division into secular matters proved by mass or experiment and sacred matters justified faith. The grey area between the two extremes is just too much to explain. We're now in the middle of the 19th century, and the estimation of the power required to drive a ship was seen as a very important topic. Discussion was frequent and often very heated. There were two kinds of errors: failure to meet the design speed, or the opposite, providing unnecessarily big, powerful and expensive machinery. Between 1838 and 1870, the British Association set up 8 different committees to consider the problem and a linked topic of the optimum form. Leading scientists and engineers contributed to the work. All were agreed that model testing was misleading and should not be considered. Next slide, please. The early committees concentrated on analysis of speed trials, of full-scale trials, in which ships were, concentrated on the speed trials of real ships, judging them on formulae of this sort. In general, the top formula was most generally used. The resistance, the power required depended on the area of the midship section times speed cubed over indicated horsepower. It works actually quite well between if the ships are fairly similar. In 1869, one of these committees recommended that a large number of real ships should be towed and their resistance measured in an attempt to find the one and only ideal form. In an apparent digression, in early 1860s, Froude began to think of the design of a new yacht for his own use. His first model had very fine ends, influenced by the Scott-Russell waveline theory, and this later became known as the Raven. A little bit later, he tried another form with very bluff ends based on the Swan. The initial results surprised even William. Raven was superior at low speeds, Swan at higher speeds. In other words, there was no single ideal form. The ideal form had to match the size and speed of the ship. This result seems so obvious now that the significance of its discovery in Froude's day, it is not apparent. But the fact that there was no single ideal form demolished totally the works started by Isaac Newton and carried on by the French mathematicians. It also demolished the idea of trying to find a single ideal form by full-scale trials. Next piece. Froude then built models of his Swan and Avon of 3 foot and 12 foot length instead of the initial 6 foot. He showed that you could scale from one to the other if the speeds tested are in the ratio of the square root of the length, then the resistance per ton of displacement is the same. Much of the resistance of a ship is due to wave making, and Froude showed that much could be done to reduce this by controlling the interference. Slide, please. Between bow and stern wave systems, he actually had this model with a long parallel section of midships, and he could put in different lengths of midship section and separate the waves produced by the bow, by the pressure field around the bow, and the waves produced at the stern, mostly deriving from a suction area beneath the hull. Next, please. Some years ago, somebody actually simulated this trial in a big computer. I thought it was Rodney Etock Taylor, but he denies all responsibility. Now, I pointed out that building and testing a wax model is actually much cheaper than several hours on a Cray computer. Next, please. Just to show that real ships make waves, that's the World War I aircraft carrier Campania, taken from an airship. Surprisingly difficult to find photographs of the wave pattern of real ships. The problem with earlier experimenters had been that they hadn't tested the models at the right speed. Most of them tested the model at the same actual linear velocity as the real ship, and hence got the wrong answer. By the time Froude came up with his law of comparison, it's fairly clear that Froude had actually seen Ricci's work in France around about 1840, in which he derived this corresponding speed approach on purely mathematical grounds. Froude derived it mainly by observation. Froude acknowledged in speaking to one government committee that he had seen French work on this theme, so he's not quite original, but Riche never seemed to think that his work was any use. It was just a mathematical curiosity to him. In 1869, the British Association Existing Knowledge Committee reported on ship powering and came up with this idea of multiple tests of real full-size ships. Froude submitted a dissenting annex, which he said that tested properly, models could give the right answer and were much cheaper. And since there were no longer any question of looking for a single form, you couldn't do it any other way. Next, please. Froude was given quite strong support by the chief constructor of the Navy, Edward Reed, who asked Froude to put in a formal submission to build a tank in which model testing could be carried out. Unfortunately, Froude's submission arrived at the Admiralty in December 1868, by which time the budget for the next year had already been fixed, and it was too late to do anything. This delay of a year is usually put down by writers to Admiralty reactionary and conservative views, but it wasn't. Having been a civil servant, you know that you can't really consider new ideas in December. Next, please. That's the plan of Froude's first tank, the Torquay, about 200 feet long, we're talking of. And it was, Froude thought he could solve all these problems in 2 years, so it was very much a lash-up structure, not intended for any long life. Next, please. This is inside the Torquay tank. The rails on which the carriage ran were specially planed for him at the Great Western Railway Works at Swindon. Next, please. The models were made of wax, and in Froude's day they were normally about 8 feet long. There's one being cast, next. The cast model coming out, next. The top being trimmed, next. There was an ingenious cutting machine which used rollers. These steel strips each represent a waterline section of the ship, and you ran a roller on that, and the cutters automatically cut the wax model to the right shape, and then you finish it off by hand. You could actually make a wax model one day, test it the next, and melt it down the same evening. Next, please. There's the cutting machine in use. Next, please. This is the carriage from which the actual drag force on the model was measured, and which towed the model so that it was constrained so that it couldn't zigzag in yaw. It could rise up and down and change its trim. Next, please. This is the actual working drawing for the carriage at Torquay. Next, please. This is the sloop Greyhound, which I mentioned in connection with bilge keel experiments. But in 1871, the Greyhound was towed behind another warship, and over the next year, the results of this full-scale towing trial were compared with model tests, and sure enough, Froude's work was justified. I'm not sure that I would have accepted it as valid, but it was far nearer than anybody else had done previously. Frictional resistance was still a slight problem, and Froude used his towing tank carriage to tow planks up to 50 feet in length down the tank and measure the resistance of purely due to friction. And he devised a rather crude set of data known as the Froude O values, from which you could estimate the frictional resistance of any model or ship. And it was a standard exam question when I was an undergraduate to show that these O values were philosophically unsound, as they contained a length term in addition to a Reynolds number term. In fact, there was quite a lot of evidence that Froude had actually got it right. Fairly soon, Froude found it necessary to test model propellers. Next, please. Wonderful piece of Victorian engineering. Wood frame, brass wheels, leather boot laces to provide the drive. And it was in use till 1938. Next, please. It was still valid in 1938. We're quite happy to use results from it. The only trouble is there were a lot of knife edges as pivots, and it required an enormous amount of maintenance to keep it operational. This is the first propeller tested at Torquay, and the other one's the last propeller tested there. Next, please. Froude's work was now generally accepted, so when the Reverend Ramus came up with an idea for a rocket-propelled ram, this, and Froude tore it to shreds, Froude's views were actually accepted. Next, please. Got slightly out of order, I'm afraid. Number of tests carried out in Torquay in red, and after the move to Hasley in blue. Next, please. A new tank was built at Hasler, across the harbour from Portsmouth, and this shows the tank in more or less original style. It's now been filled in, it's an accountant's office. The carriage is very ingenious. The main members are all wooden box girders with steel wires let in on the tension side. Next, please. William's wife, Catherine, died in 1878, which caused him much distress. And in 1879, he was offered a holiday to South Africa in a warship. And while in South Africa, he died very suddenly of dysentery. Active to the last, he wrote a long letter on the soaring of birds, which formed the basis of a posthumous paper. Froude and Henry Brunel always dreamt of producing a flying machine. They knew quite well that the technology of the day wasn't up to it, but they kept on hoping. William Froude changed a small but important part of the world, and his law of comparison based on Froude number remains valid today. In the Honours School of Genius, I would call him an upper second, perhaps. He wasn't a Clerk Maxwell or a Faraday changing the whole world, but he did change something that was quite important. I make no apologies by concluding with his three favourite sayings. Our sacred duty is doubt, probability is the guide to life, and Pasteur's saying, in the field of observation, chance favours only the trained observer. The great man approach to history has few supporters today, but let's conclude by trying to imagine what would have happened if Froude hadn't been wiped from the record. The leading scientists in the British Association Committee were still looking for a single ideal form and were opposed to model tests. There was a meeting of the Institution of Naval Architects in 1870, which was totally and quite viciously opposed to Froude and his works. He had strong support from Crossland, who was capable of original thought, but there's no indication that Crossland would have made the breakthrough. France had been teaching Riche's work since the 1840s, but nobody seemed to have thought of using it. Only in Holland did Tiedemann work on the right lines, but he had even more opposition and less support than Froude. Next, please. After the move to Hasler, virtually every warship of World War I, here you see the Grand Fleet at Scapa Flow, and most of the World War II fleet were tested. Next, please. This has got out slightly out of order, and it shows the original Froude dynamometer on the back end of the sloop Conquest. As far as I know, it was only used that once for trial and then put in a storage the next 100 years. But as some of you know very well, the principle of the Froude dynamometer still lives today. And again, we thank Hoffmann Froude. Next, please. That's the big tank at Hasler today. It's sadly run down. Lots of other people copied the Froude approach to ship model testing. The tanks at Spezia and St. Petersburg were designed and supervised by Edmund Froude. The great US pioneer, David Taylor, learnt his trade at Hasler. Is there another one? Oh, we'll close with a picture. First of William, next please. And this is all that's left of the Torquay tank, just a plaque on the wall, which had quite recently been given a wash and brush up, apparently. Next, please. That should be the lot, is it? OK, we've got about 30 seconds for questions. Froude working with us. he was equally insistent. No, definitely Froude. When I first went to Hasler, there was an old lady in the village who remembered Edmund Froude. When she was a little girl, he used to give her an apple when she passed his house. Couldn't happen today. Imagine an elderly bachelor giving fruit to children. Okay, while I'm waiting for more questions, let me ask you one. I mentioned that Froude did his best maths at age 50. Do you believe that mathematical ability declines rapidly from the age of 30? Any views on that one?
I actually think that all the evidence says that people who do pure mathematics have their greatest insights when they're still very young. I think that anybody who does applied mathematics and engineering, I think that that's quite the contrary. I think it's actually the judicious choice of problems and the experience of what you learn, you can get better and better. And I know many people who've been working in engineering and applied mathematics and who've done their very best work when they're in their 50s and 60s. I don't know anybody who's a pure mathematician who did his best work after the age of 40.
I think I would agree with that. A slightly related one. I read fairly recently that calculus was first taught in British universities in around about 1830. Prior to that, there was this horrible thing called Newtonian fractions. The Admiralty School of Naval Architecture seems to have been teaching calculus in 1811. And Oxford caught up in... Your centenary ought almost to be a matter of shame rather than congratulations.
One more question.
Yeah, you pointed out in your talk that the Froude family were quite involved in the Oxford movement. And of course, Froude's tutor at Oriel was the later Cardinal Newman. Can you say a bit more about the effect you think that might have had on Froude's later scientific work?
Well, I think only in this saying of his, our sacred duty to doubt. As I think he found himself questioning, first of all, Newman's attitude to faith, and this led Froude to take the same attitude to scientific work, to doubt everything and demand proof and validation and experimental proof.
But Newman would have accepted that some things were axiomatically true, but you're suggesting, I mean, Froude never took that point of view, would never have accepted that. Everything was subject to doubt.
No, he wasn't daft about it. I mean, he didn't spend every minute doubting everything. He accepted that quite a bit of it was good enough to be going on with. And only when he saw the need for improvement did he really let his doubts take over. But one of the great things about Froude was what a nice man he was. In an obituary written by Henry Brunel, Henry says, "What a pleasure it was to be sent on an errand by Froude. His mere mention of his name will get such willing service."
Mordell's an example of a mathematician who did good work late in life. I don't think that one should be talking about things that are that hard to measure, what's good work and what's not good work. But I do have a question for you. You seem to say that the ships that were less stable rolled less. What kind of stability are you talking about when you say that?
Well, to the naval architect, stability is defined as the a measure of the ability to turn up to return to the upright when displaced from the upright. Usually defined for small angles of field by what we call the metacentric height, as the force of buoyancy will act through the metacenter, and the weight through the centre of gravity, and if these are combining to pull you upright, the ship is stable. If you get the wrong side of the metacenter, the ship is unstable and will capsize. So a stiff ship is a stable ship and will usually suffer from very jerky rolling. Your sloppy ship will roll easily and is comfortable, but is not really all that safe. Froude's views on this were widely misunderstood, and a lot of liners at the end of the 19th and early 20th century had what we would consider now to be grossly inadequate stability, such as the troop ship I went out to Malta in.
Professor E. Toktay will give a summing up. I think other questions can be asked in the drinks afterwards.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not sure it's going to be a summing up, but a vote of thanks. I think we've all heard a fascinating lecture by somebody who comes across in the way he's described Froude as a biographer and a historian. And we know that David has written at least 11 books, I think it is, about various aspects of ships and naval architecture, including probably the definitive book on Froude, which was published last year, isn't it?
Yes, and I have some older forms.
There are older forms. More than that, David is through and through an engineer, and I think that has become very clear from particularly some of the answers to his questions. I actually have had the good fortune to have known or met David a long time ago in the early 1970s, when he was lecturing on ship structures at University College London.
Ship hydrodynamics.
That's just as well. Thanks for correcting. Ship hydrodynamics. I was working on ship structures, hence my slip of the tongue. But actually, I quickly discovered, to my own satisfaction, that it was more interesting to look at the loading on ships and ship hydrodynamics than ship structures. And hence I was introduced both to David and to William Froude about the same time, because I hadn't actually had the benefit of the Oxford education with Froude's law and all that. Maybe I should have done at the other place, but I don't remember anything about Froude at that time. Anyhow, David is very much an engineer, but he chose out of the various aphorisms of Froude what to hang his lecture on, the sacred duty of diet. I think it would have been interesting to engineers if he'd chosen probability as the guide to life, or one might say to engineers nowadays, probability as the guide. However, I don't think that would have been anything like appropriate as a lecture to a mixed audience such as we have, so I think he got it right in that respect. Talking of the audience, I'd just like to welcome, if I may, on behalf of the department, the Provost of Oriel, who, as we've heard, was the College of William Froude, Sir Eric Morris, who's sitting up at the back. We're very pleased that you were able to join us. And I'm sure you would have learned quite a bit about one of your alumni that you may not have been aware of previously. David has pitched his lecture just right, I think, and I'd like to read from a review of one of his books, Warship Development 1860 to 1905, Warrior to Dreadnought, where the reviewer said, "There is a risk with a book such as this that the result will be a highly technical piece of interest only to those in the know. This is definitely not the case. Warrior to Dreadnought, the book, is an exceptionally well-written book which will appeal to the expert while also bringing the subject alive to those with an interest, but little or no technical knowledge." Well, I think you'll agree that that has been just what we've had. There have been things for all of us to chew our teeth on, particularly those with an interest in hydrodynamics, but I think all of you with any general interest. And so I would like you to join me in thanking David very much for his lecture and for this wonderful, inspirational contribution to our centenary series. Thank you very much.
Rodney has reminded me of something. The high point of my career in many
ways.
Probably around about 1960, I was working on propeller design, and that was real engineering in those days. We started off with what was, for its day, some fairly advanced mathematical work. We then made a model, put it in a cavitation tunnel, and did some fairly scientific experiments. You would then call up Joe the fitter, who made the model, saying, "Joe, see where those bubbles are coming up? File a bit off and see what happens." And eventually we come to what seemed to be the optimum. If you spoilt one blade, there were four more, so you usually got some improvement. You then take a wax impression of the finished model and build a full size the same one. And Joe would come up and you'd watch it through glass windows in the bottom of a ship and see that it behaved the same as the model. And it didn't always. And I'm sure I've heard the magic phrase, "hit it with a hammer."
Lastly, for those with an interest in Royal Hydrodynamics, there are some drinks. Go out through the main doors and to the left into the Holder building, the Holder common room. Essentially follow those in the know. Thank you very much.